You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of the Bhagavad Gita and the West. This is the second cycle in the book. It is lecture two in that cycle, however, for the sake of continuity in this file, I am referring to it as lecture seven, given in Helsinki, May 29th, 1913. The deeper we go into the esoteric records of various ages and peoples, that is to say, into the truly esoteric records, the more we are struck by one feature that meets us again and again. I already indicated this when discussing the Gospel of John, and on a later occasion when speaking of the Gospel of Mark. I refer to the fact that on looking deeply into any such esoteric record, it becomes ever clearer that it is really most wonderfully composed, that it forms an artistic whole. I could show, for instance, how John's Gospel, when we penetrate into its depths, reveals a wonderful artistic composition. With remarkable dramatic power, the story is carried stage by stage toward a great climax, and then continues from this point onward with a kind of renewal of dramatic power to the end. You can study this in the lectures I gave in Kassel on John's Gospel in relation to the three other Gospels, especially to that according to Luke, footnote, titled The Gospel of St. John and Its Relation to the Other Gospels, given in Kassel, June 24th to July 7th, 1909, New York at the Basophic Press, 1982. This cycle is also available on this website. End of footnote. Most impressive is the gradual enhancement of this inner dramatic composition, which becomes visible in John's Gospel, so that from so-called miracles and signs, the supersensible is presented from sign to sign, and from sign to sign there is continual enlargement until we get to the sign of the initiation of Lazarus. It makes us realize how we can always find artistic beauty at the foundation of these esoteric records. I could say the same about the composition of the Gospel of Mark. When we regard such records in their formal beauty and dramatic power, we can indeed conclude that just because they are true, such records cannot be other than artistically, beautifully composed, in the deepest sense of the word. For the moment, we will only indicate this fact, as we may come back to it in the course of these lectures. Now, it is remarkable that the same thing meets us again in the Bhagavad Gita. There is a wonderful intensification of the narrative. Let us begin by indicating a few of the outstanding points, and we will confine ourselves today to the first four discourses, because these points are important both for the artistic structure and for the deep esoteric truths that it contains. First, Arjuna meets us. Facing the bloodshed in which he is to take part, he grows weak. He sees all that is to take place as a battle of brothers against brothers, his blood relations. He shrinks back. He will not fight against them. While fear and terror overcome him and he is horror-stricken, his charioteer suddenly appears as the instrument through which Krishna, God, is to speak to him. In this very first episode, we have a moment of great intensity and also an indication of deep esoteric truth. Anyone who finds the way by whatever path into the spiritual worlds, even though he or she may have gone only a few steps, or even had only a dim presentiment of the way to be experienced, such a person will be aware of the deep significance of this moment. As a rule, we cannot enter the spiritual worlds without passing through a deep upheaval in our souls. We have to experience something that disturbs and shakes all our forces, flooding our soul with intense feelings and sensations. Emotions that are generally spread out over many moments, over long periods of living, whose permanent effect on the soul is therefore weaker. Such feelings are concentrated in a single moment and storm through us with tremendous force when we enter the esoteric worlds. Then we experience a kind of inner shattering, which can indeed be compared to fear, terror and anxiety, as though we were shrinking back from something in horror. Such experiences belong to the initial stages of esoteric development, to entering the spiritual worlds. Just for this reason, great care must be taken to give the right advice to those who would enter the spiritual world through esoteric training. We must be prepared so that we may experience this upheaval as a necessary event in our soul life, without its encroaching on our bodily life and health. And insofar as the body is included, it must suffer a like upheaval. That is the essential thing. We must learn to suffer the convulsions of our soul with outward equanimity and calm. This is true not only for our bodily processes. The soul forces we need for everyday living, our ordinary intellectual powers, even those of imagination, of feeling and will, these too must not be allowed to become unbalanced. The upheaval that may be the starting point for esoteric life must take place in far deeper layers of the soul, so that we go through our external life as before, without anything being noticed in us outwardly, while, within, we may be living through whole worlds of shattering soul experience. That is what it means to be ripe for esoteric development, to be able to experience such inward convulsions without losing one's outer balance and calm. To this end, those striving to become ripe for esoteric development must widen the circle of their interests beyond everyday life. They must get away from the things which otherwise keep us going from morning to night, and reach out to interests that move on the great horizon of the world. We must be able to undergo the experience of doubting all truth and all knowledge. We must have the power to do this with the same intensity of feeling people generally have only where their everyday interests are concerned. We must be able to feel with the destiny of all humankind, with as much interest as we usually feel in our own destiny, or perhaps in that of our nearest connections of clan, family, or nation. If we cannot do this, we are not yet completely ready for esoteric development. For this reason, modern anthroposophy, if pursued earnestly and worthily, is the right preparation for true esoteric development in our age. Let those who are absorbed in the petty, material interests of the immediate present, who cannot find the interest to follow the anthroposophist in looking out over world and planetary destinies, over the historical epochs and races of humankind, let them scoff if they will. Those who would prepare themselves for esoteric development must lift up their eyes to the heights where the interests of humankind, of the earth, of the whole planetary system become their own. The person whose interests are gradually sharpened and widened through the study of anthroposophy, including esoteric training, to an understanding of esoteric truths, is being rightly prepared for an esoteric path. There are many people nowadays who have such an interest in the whole of humankind. More often than not, we shall not find them among intellectuals, but among people who seem to lead quite simple lives and feel this interest as if by natural instinct. That is why anthroposophy is in such harmony with the spirit of our age. First, then, we must experience the mighty upheaval of the soul that has to come at the beginning of esoteric experience. With wonderful truth, the Bhagavad Gita sets such a moment of upheaval at the starting point of Arjuna's experience, only he does not undergo an esoteric training, but is placed into this moment by his destiny. He is placed into the battle without being able to recognize its necessity, its purpose, or its aim. All he sees is that his relatives are about to fight against each other. A soul, such as Arjuna's, can be shaken to its innermost core by that experience, for he has to say to himself, quote, "Brother fights against brother. Surely then all tribal customs will be shaken, and then the tribe itself will wither away and be destroyed. and all its morality fall into decay. Those laws that place men into castes in accordance with an eternal destiny will be shaken, and then will everything be imperiled. Humanity itself, the law, the whole world. The whole significance of humankind will be in the balance. Close quote. Such is his feeling. It is as though the ground were about to sink from under his feet, as though an abyss were opening up before him. Arjuna was a man who had received into his feeling something that people nowadays no longer know, but that in those ancient times was a primeval teaching of tradition. He knew that what is handed on from generation to generation in humankind is bound up with female nature, while the individual personal qualities, whereby a person stands out from blood connections and family line, are bound up with male nature. What a person inherits as common generic qualities is handed on to the descendants by the woman, whereas what forms that person into a unique individual being, tearing one out of the generic succession, is the part received from the father. Quote, "If blood fights against blood, must it not then have an evil effect on the laws that rule woman's nature?" Close quote, Arjuna says to himself. Arjuna has now absorbed another feeling, another impression, upon which depends for him what he sees as the healthy course of future human evolution. He feels that the forefathers of the tribe, the ancestors, are worthy of honor. He feels that their souls watch over the succeeding generations. For him it is a sublime service to offer up sacrificial fires to the manes. I'm going to spell that is M-A-N-E-S, I believe that's a plural. Footnote, see Manas, Roman Dreams of the Dean, in Simon Hornblower and Anthony Spalforth, editors, the Oxford Classical Dictionary, New York Oxford University Press, 1996, page 916. I believe M-A-N-E-S is the plural. I'm going to pronounce that Manes. Read again. For him, it is a sublime service to offer up sacrificial fires to the Manes, to the holy souls of the ancestors. But now, what is he forced to see? Instead of altars with sacrificial fires burning on them for the ancestors, he sees those who should join in kindling the fires assailing one another in battle. If we would understand a human soul, we must penetrate into its thoughts. Above all, we must enter deeply into its feelings, because it is in feeling that the soul is intimately bound up with its very life. Think now of the great contrast between all that Arjuna would naturally feel and the bloody battle of brother against brother that is about to take place. Destiny is hammering at Arjuna's soul, shaking it to its very depths. It is as though he had to gaze down into a terrible abyss. Such an upheaval awakens the forces of the soul and brings it to a vision of esoteric realities that are, at other times, hidden as behind a veil. That is what gives such dramatic intensity to the Bhagavad Gita. The ensuing discourse is thus placed before us with wonderful power, developing of necessity out of Arjuna's destiny, instead of being given us merely as an academic, pedantic course of instruction in esotericism. Now that Arjuna has been rightly prepared for the birth of the deeper forces of his soul, now that he has an inward vision of these forces, something happens which everyone with the power to behold will understand. His charioteer becomes the instrument through which the god Krishna speaks to him. In the first four discourses, we observe three successive stages, each higher than the last, each one introducing something new. Here in these first discourses, we find an accent that is a wonder of dramatic artistry, apart from the fact that it corresponds to a deep esoteric truth. The first stage is a teaching that may appear downright trivial to many Westerners in its given form. Let us admit this at once. Here I should like to remark especially for the benefit of my dear friends here in Finland, that I mean by Western all that lies to the west of the Ural Mountains, the Volga, the Caspian Sea, and Asia Minor, in fact the whole of Europe. What is to be called Eastern land belongs essentially in Asia. Of course, America, too, forms part of the West, close parentheses. To begin with, then, we find a teaching that may easily appear trivial, especially to a philosophical mind. For what is the first thing that Krishna says to Arjuna as an exhortation to battle? Quote, "Look there," he says, "at those who are to be killed by you, those in your own ranks who are to be killed, and those who are to remain behind. And consider well this one fact. What dies and what remains alive in your ranks and in those of the enemy is but the outer physical body. This deepest being of humanity is not affected in this battle. Rise, Arjuna, rise to the spiritual standpoint, and then you can go and give yourself up to your duty. You need not shudder nor be sad at heart, for in killing your enemies you are not killing their essential being." Close quote. Thus speaks Krishna. And upon first hearing them, his words are in some sense trivial. Footnote: Steiner refers to Krishna's words about reincarnation, and not to his directive to fight, which is hardly trivial. End of footnote. Yet trivial in a very remarkable way. In many respects, Westerners are short-sighted in their thinking and consciousness. They never stop to consider that everything is evolving. If they say that Krishna's exhortation, as I have described it, expressed it, is trivial, it is as though one were to say, quote, "Why do they honor Pythagoras as such a great man when every schoolboy and girl knows his theorem?" Close quote. It would be foolish to conclude that Pythagoras was not a great man in having discovered his theorem just because every schoolchild now understands it. We see how foolish this is. But we do not notice when we fail to realize that the wisdom of Krishna, which any Western philosopher may recite by rote, that the spirit is eternal, immortal, etc., was a sublime wisdom at the time Krishna revealed it. Souls like Arjuna did indeed feel that blood relations ought not to fight. They still felt the common blood that flowed in a group of people. To hear it said that, quote, "the spirit is eternal," close quote, parenthesis, spirit in the sense of what is generally conceived abstractly as the center of the human being, close parenthesis, this stated in abstract and intellectual terms was something absolutely new and epoch-making in its newness, when it resounded in Arjuna's soul through Krishna's words. All the people in Arjuna's environment definitely believed in reincarnation, but as Krishna taught it, as a general and abstract idea, it was new, especially in regard to Arjuna's situation. This is one reason why we had to say that such a truth can only be called trivial in a special sense. That holds true in another respect as well. Our abstract thinking, which we use even in the pursuit of popular science, which we regard today as quite natural, this thinking activity was by no means always so natural and simple. In order to illustrate what I say, let me give you a radical example. You will think it strange that while for all of you it is quite natural to speak of a fish, it was by no means natural for primeval peoples to do so. Ancient peoples were acquainted with trout and salmon, cod and herring, but, in quotes, "fish," they did not know. They had no such word as "fish," because their thought did not extend to such abstract generalization. They knew birch trees, cherry trees, orange trees, individual trees, but, in quotes, "tree," they did not know. Even now, thinking in such general concepts is by no means natural to indigenous people. This mode of thinking has indeed only entered humanity in the course of its evolution. In fact, one who considers why it was that logic first began in the time of ancient Greece could scarcely be surprised when the statement is made on esoteric grounds that logical thinking has only existed since the period that followed the original composition of the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna, impels Arjuna to think logically, to think in abstractions, to a new way of thinking that is only now entering humanity. Footnote. Steiner seems to mean that Arjuna was to be one of the first to be capable of this kind of thinking, which after 2.5 millennia has only today become a widely shared capacity. End of footnote. But people have the most distorted and unnatural notions about this activity of thinking that human beings have developed and take for granted today. Western philosophers in particular have the most distorted ideas about thinking, for they generally take it to be merely a photographic reproduction of external sense reality. They imagine that concepts and ideas and all of human thinking simply arise out of the external physical world. While libraries of philosophical glossaries have been written in the West to prove that thought is merely something that originates in response to the stimuli of the external physical world, only in our time will thought be valued for what it really is. Here I reach a point that is most important for those who would undergo esoteric development in their own souls. I want to make every effort to get this point clear. Medieval alchemists used to say, I cannot now discuss what they really meant by it, that gold could be made from all metals, gold in any desired amount, but that one must first have a minute quantity of it. Without that, one could not make gold. Whether or not this is true of gold, it is certainly true of clairvoyance. No one could actually attain clairvoyance if one did not have a tiny amount of it already in one's soul. It is generally supposed that people are not as such clairvoyant. If that were true, they could never become clairvoyant at all, because just as the alchemist thought that one must have a little gold to conjure forth large quantities, so must one already be a little clairvoyant in order to be able to develop and extend it more and more. Now you may see two alternatives here and ask, quote, do you think, then, that we all are clairvoyant, if only slightly, or do you think that those of us who are not clairvoyant can never become so? Close quote. This is just the point. It is most important to understand that there is really no one among you who does not have this starting point of clairvoyance, though you may not be conscious of it. You all have it. None of you is lacking in it. What is this that all possess? It is something not generally regarded or valued as clairvoyance. Let me make a rather crude comparison. If a pearl is lying in the roadway and a chicken finds it, the chicken does not value the pearl. Most men and women today are chickens in this respect. They do not value the pearl that lies there in full view before them. What they value is something quite different. They value their concepts and ideas, but no one could think abstractly, could have thoughts and ideas without being clairvoyant. The pearl of clairvoyance is contained in our ordinary thinking from the start. Ideas arise in the soul through exactly the same process as what gives rise to its highest powers. It is immensely important to learn to understand that clairvoyance begins in something common and everyday. We only have to recognize the supersensible nature of our concepts and ideas. We must realize that these come to us from the supersensible worlds. Only then can we look at the matter correctly. When I tell you of the upper hierarchies, of seraphim and cherubim and thrones, right down to archangels and angels, these are beings that must speak to the human soul from higher spiritual worlds. It is from those worlds that concepts and ideas come into the human soul, not from the world of the senses. In the 18th century, what was considered at the time a great call was uttered by one of the Enlightenment philosophers. Quote, O humanity, make bold to use thy power of reason. Close quote. Footnote, Immanuel Kant, 1724-1804, exclaimed, Dare to reason. Close quote, or end of footnote. Today, a great word must resonate in human souls. Quote, O humanity, make bold to claim thy concepts and ideas as the beginning of thy clairvoyance. Close quote. What I have just expressed, I said publicly many years ago in my books titled Truth and Science and titled The Philosophy of Freedom. In footnote, Philosophy of Freedom is also translated and is in this on this website as titled Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path. End of footnote. Continue. Where I showed that human ideas come from supersensible spiritual knowledge. It was not understood at the time. And no wonder, for those who should have understood it were, well, like the chickens. We must realize that at the moment when Krishna stands before Arjuna and gives him the power of abstract judgment, he is thereby giving him, for the first time, in the whole of evolution, the starting point for the knowledge of higher worlds. The spirit can be seen on the very surface of the changes that take place within the external world of sense. Bodies die. The spirit, the abstract, the essential being, is eternal. The spiritual can be seen playing on the surface of phenomena. This is what Krishna would reveal to Arjuna as the beginning of a new clairvoyance for human beings. When you have this experience in your world of ideas, when the full cup of doubt in all existence has been poured out with pain and bitterness over your soul, only then are you ripe to understand how, after all, it is not the infinite spaces and periods of time of the physical world from which your ideas have come. Only then, after the bitterness of doubt, can you open yourself to the regions of the spirit and know that your doubt was justified, and in what sense it was justified. For it had to be, since you imagined that the ideas had come into your soul from the times and spaces of the physical world. How do you now feel your world of ideas, having experienced its origin in the spiritual worlds? Now, for the first time, you feel yourself inspired. Before, you were feeling the infinite void spread around you like a dark abyss. Now you begin to feel that you are standing on a rock that rises up out of the abyss. You know with certainty, quote, "Now I am connected with the spiritual worlds. They, not the world of sense, have bestowed on me my world of ideas." Close quote. One thing is necessary for people today if they would attain an inward experience of truth. They must have once passed through the feeling of the fleeting nature of all outer transformations. They must have experienced the mood of infinite sadness, of infinite tragedy, and at the same time the exaltation of joy. They must have felt the breath of the ephemeral that streams out from all things. They must have been able to fix their interest on this coming forth and passing away again, the transitoriness of the world of sense. Then, when they have been able to feel the deepest pain and the fullest delight in the external world, they must once have been absolutely alone, alone with their concepts and ideas. They must have had the feeling, quote, "In these concepts I grasp the mystery of the worlds, I take hold of the outer edge of cosmic being," close quote, the very expression I once used in my title Philosophy of Freedom. This must be experienced, not merely understood intellectually. And if you would experience it, it must be in deepest loneliness. Then you have another feeling. On the one hand, you experience the majesty of the world of ideas that is spread out over the all. On the other hand, you experience with the deepest bitterness that you have to separate yourself from space and time in order to be at one with your concepts and ideas. Loneliness. It is the icy cold of loneliness. Furthermore, it comes to you that the world of ideas has now drawn together as into a single point of loneliness. Now you say, "I am alone with my world of ideas." You become utterly bewildered in your world of ideas, an experience that stirs you to the depths of your soul. At length, you can say to yourself, at length you say to yourself, quote, "Perhaps all this is only I, myself. Perhaps the only truth about these laws is that they exist in the point of my own loneliness." Close quote. Thus you experience infinitely enhanced, utter doubt in all existence. This is the next stage for the evolving soul. It is the stage where we begin to be deeply in earnest with what has today come to be a trivial, commonplace truth. To bear this feeling in your heart will prepare you to receive in a true way the first truth that Krishna gives to Arjuna after the mighty upheaval and convulsion in his soul, the truth of the eternal spirit living through outer transformations. To abstract understanding, we speak in concepts and ideas. Krishna speaks to Arjuna's heart. What may be trivial and commonplace to the understanding is infinitely deep and sublime to the human heart. We see how the first stage shows itself at once as a necessary consequence of the deeply moving experience that is presented to us at the start of the Bhagavad Gita. And now to the next stage. It is easy to speak of what is often called dogma in esotericism, something that is accepted in blind faith and given out as gospel truth. Let me suggest to you that it would be quite simple for someone to come forward and say, quote, "This man has published a book on esoteric science, speaking in it about Saturn, Sun, and Moon evolutions, and there is no way of controlling these statements. They can only be accepted as dogma." Close quote. Footnote, Rudolf Steiner, this book is called, title, An Outline of Esoteric Science, first published in 1909, end of footnote. I could understand such a statement, because it corresponds to the superficial nature of our age. And there is no getting away from it, our age is superficial. Indeed, under certain conditions, this objection would not be without foundation. It would be justified, for example, if you were to tear out of the book all the pages that precede the chapter on the Saturn evolution. If anyone were to begin reading the book at this chapter, it would be nothing but dogma. If, however, the author prefaces it with the other chapters, he is by no means a dogmatist, because he knows what paths the soul has to travel in order to reach such conceptions. That is the point. That it has been shown in the book how every individual, reaching into the depths of his or her soul, is bound to come to such conceptions. Herein, all dogmatism ceases. Thus it may feel natural that Krishna, having brought Arjuna into the world of ideas and wishing to lead him into the esoteric world, now proceeds to show him the next stage, how every soul can reach that higher world if it finds the right starting point. Krishna then must begin by rejecting every form of dogmatism, and he does so radically. Here we come up against a hard saying by Krishna. He absolutely rejects what for centuries had been most holy to the highest minds of that age, the contents of the Vedas. He says, quote, "Hold not to the Vedas, nor to the word of the Vedas. Hold fast to yoga." Close quote. That is to say, quote, "Hold fast to what is within thine own soul." Close quote. Let us grasp what Krishna means by this exhortation. He does not mean that the contents of the Vedas are untrue. He does not want Arjuna to accept what is given in the Vedas dogmatically, as do the disciples of the Vedic teaching. He wants to inspire him to take his start from the very first original point whence the human soul evolves. For this purpose, all dogmatic wisdom must be laid aside. We can imagine Krishna saying to himself that even though Arjuna will in the end reach the very same wisdom that is contained in the Vedas, still he must be drawn away from them, for he must go his own way, beginning with the sources in his own soul. Krishna rejects the Vedas, whether their content is true or untrue. Arjuna's path must start from himself. Through his own inwardness he must come to recognize Krishna. Arjuna must be assumed to have in himself what one can and must have if one is really to enter into the concrete truths of the supersensible worlds. Krishna has called Arjuna's attention to something that from then onward is a common attribute of humanity. Having led him to this point, he must lead him further and bring him to recognize what he is to achieve through yoga. Thus Arjuna must first undergo yoga. Here the poem rises to another level. In this second stage, we see how the Bhagavad Gita goes through the first four discourses with ever-increasing dramatic force, coming at length to what is most individual. Krishna describes to Arjuna the path of yoga. We shall speak of this in more detail tomorrow. He describes the path that Arjuna must take in order to pass from the everyday clairvoyance of concepts and ideas to what can only be attained through yoga. Concepts only require to be placed in the right light, but Arjuna has to be guided to yoga. This is the second stage. The third stage shows once more an enhancement of dramatic power and the expression of a deep esoteric truth. Let us assume that someone takes the yoga path. Such a person will rise at length from his ordinary consciousness to a higher state of consciousness, which includes not only the ego that lies between the limits of birth and death, but also what passes from one incarnation to the next. The soul awakens to know itself in an expanded ego. It grows into a wider consciousness. The soul goes through a process that is essentially an everyday process, but is not experienced fully in our everyday life because we go to sleep every night. As the sense world fades, we become unconscious of it. For every human soul, the possibility exists of letting this world of sense vanish from consciousness, as it does when we go to sleep, and then to live in higher worlds as in an absolute reality. Thereby humans rise to a higher level of consciousness. We shall still have to speak of yoga, and also of the modern exercises that make this possible. But if we gradually reach a point where we no longer consciously live and feel and know in ourselves, but live and feel and know together with the whole earth, then we grow into a higher level of consciousness, where the things of the sense world vanish for us, as they do in sleep. However, before we can attain this level, we must be able to identify ourselves with the soul of the earth. We shall see that this is possible. We know that human beings not only experience the rhythm of sleeping and waking, but other rhythms of the earth as well, of summer and winter. When one follows the path of yoga or goes through a modern esoteric training, it is possible to lift oneself above the ordinary consciousness that experiences the cycles of sleeping and waking, summer and winter. One can learn to look at oneself from outside. One becomes aware of being able to look back at oneself just as one ordinarily looks at things outside the self. Now we observe the cycles in external life. We see alternating conditions. We realize how the body, as long as one is outside of oneself, takes on a form similar to that of the earth in summer, with all its vegetation. What material science discovers and calls nerves, we begin to perceive as a sprouting forth of something plant-like when going to sleep. When we return to everyday consciousness, we feel how this plant-like life shrinks together again and becomes the instrument for thinking, feeling, and willing in waking consciousness. One feels one's going out from the body and returning into it as analogous to the alternation of summer and winter on the earth. In effect, we feel something summer-like in going to sleep and something winter-like in waking up. Not, as one might imagine, the opposite way around. From this moment onward, we learn to understand what the spirit of the earth is, and how it is asleep in summer and awake in winter, not vice versa. We realize the wonderful experience of identifying ourselves with the spirit of the earth. From this moment on, one says, quote, "I live not only inside my skin, but as a cell lives in my bodily organism, so do I live in the organism of the earth." The earth is asleep in summer and awake in winter, as I am asleep and awake in the alternation of night and day. And as the cell is to my consciousness, so am I to the consciousness of the earth. Close quote. The path of yoga, especially in its modern sense, leads to this expansion of consciousness, to the identification of our own being with a more comprehensive being. We feel ourselves interwoven with the whole earth. Then we no longer feel ourselves bound as humans to a particular time and place, but we feel our humanity such as it has developed from the very beginning of the earth. We feel the age-long succession of our evolutions through the course of earth evolution. Thus, yoga leads us on to feel our at-one-ment with what goes from one incarnation to another in the earth's evolution. That is the third stage. This is the reason for the great beauty in the artistic composition of the Bhagavad Gita. In its climaxes, its inner artistic form, it reflects deep esoteric truths. Beginning with an instruction in the ordinary concepts of our thinking, it goes on to an indication of the path of yoga. Then at the third stage, it describes the marvelous expansion of humanity's horizon over the whole earth, where Krishna awakens in Arjuna the idea, quote, "All that lives in your soul has lived often before, only you know nothing of it. But I have this consciousness in myself when I look back on all the transformations through which I have lived, and I will draw you to me so that you may learn to feel yourself as I feel myself." Close quote. This is a new moment of dramatic force, as beautiful as it is deeply and mysteriously true. Thus we come to see the evolution of humankind from out of its everyday consciousness, from the pearl in the roadway that only needs to be recognized, from the particular world of thoughts and concepts that are a matter of everyday life in any one age, up to the point from where we can look out over all that we really have in us, which lives on from incarnation to incarnation on the earth. The end of Lecture 7, which is also Lecture 2 in the second part of the book, which, by the way, is entitled in the original edition, The Occult Significance of the Bhagavad Gita.